Do you ever wonder whether every breast cancer patient is treated the same? I know it's a strange thing to ask, but I did, until I listened to this week's guest talking about her experiences of treatment. Several of you have shared your own stories with me, saying that cancer isn't talked about in your community. And you're also wondering why you don't see yourself represented in the breast cancer space. Today, I'm going to be speaking about this with Leanne Perro, MBE. She's the founder of Black Women Rising, and she's leading the charge in making breast cancer more inclusive for women of colour. This is So Now I've Got Breast Cancer, the podcast for anyone who's just been diagnosed. I'm Dr. Liz O'Riordan, the breast surgeon with breast cancer, and I found out the hard way just how little I knew when I suddenly found myself in the chemo chair. It's why I wrote my book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer. There's a lot of bad information out there, and I want to guide you down the right path. So if you've got a question, this show will answer it for you. I didn't realise until a couple of years ago that some Black women have a very different experience of breast cancer compared to women like me. And the same is probably true for Black men, but we don't have the data yet. We know that Black women are more likely to have triple negative breast cancer and are often diagnosed at a later stage compared to white women. And there's also data to show that Black and South Asian women have significantly lower survival rates. Now, this week's guest is trying to do something about it. Leanne Perro, MBE, set up her own foundation after being diagnosed with breast cancer, which led to the launch of the amazing support project Black Women Rising. And one of their surveys found that 96 out of 100 women of colour did not see themselves represented in media coverage of breast cancer. I can't wait to explore this further and see how I can help Leanne to continue her incredible work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Liz. I love that introduction. I love that.
It's all true. So to start with, can you tell us all a bit about your story? What was your experience like as a young Black woman going through breast cancer treatment?
Definitely. So I was diagnosed 6 months after my mum was diagnosed with breast cancer for the second time. So cancer, I knew about breast cancer, I knew the signs and symptoms. And to put it in a nutshell, although I was really, really shocked when I found my lump and was diagnosed 6 months after her, I was very, very informed because I had gone through it with her.
Yeah.
Totally, of course, I was a fit and healthy dance and fitness instructor, 30 years old, out of 4 sisters, absolute shell shock that I was the one that was diagnosed with breast cancer. But we were really informed. I think for me, what was a huge thing was first and foremost, I did, and I always say it, I felt like I was the only Black girl, 30-year-old, diagnosed with breast cancer. Why? Because everywhere I looked in the waiting room, at the patients that were in that waiting room, when I saw the leaflets in the hospital, nothing represented me. And then, you know, it was the reactions from people when I told people within my community. So not necessarily my immediate family, but it was friends and acquaintances, you know, people saying, Black people don't usually get cancer. What is that for you? My mum is mixed race, so it was like, oh, that must be the white gene, someone said to me. And yeah, and it was little things like that, you know, like chemo's not made for Black people. Black people don't usually do well on chemo. And then I was told by some church leaders not to cut off my breasts because God wouldn't want me to cut off my breasts. Yes. And as shocking as it sounds, unfortunately, 4 years on from setting up, you know, Black Women Rising, these are stories that are absolutely echoed time and time again from the women who sign up to the program. So, yeah, I would say there was a lot of ignorance around my diagnosis.
I just can't believe what I'm hearing, but I know from you that it's true. Now, you set up your foundation in 2019 and that led to Black Women Rising. Can you tell me how it came about and what you wanted to achieve with it all?
Well, exactly. It led on from that diagnosis and the kind of isolation that I felt with the diagnosis. There was just this constant wanting to seek other women who looked like me, who maybe have been the same age as me. But I'll tell you the poignant moment that made me sort of set it up was when I did find that my hospital, my inner city London hospital, by the way, was running a support group. And I went along, as you usually do, and I walked into this room. I was slightly late, and I could see that the room was really packed, but it was packed with women who did not look like me. So a lot of women who were a lot older, but also were white women as well. I had no problem with that, and I walked into the room. But the person who was running the support group turned around and asked me, in front of everybody, what was I doing there? And when I said to her that I'm here to join the group, she asked me, for your mum? Are you with your mum? And I said, no, I've got cancer. And she said, oh my God, I am so sorry. You look far too young to be in this room. She also gave me a little bit of a compliment. She said, you look really well as well. And I know that she didn't mean anything by it. But yeah, that was really isolating to me, because I thought, wow, you know, first and foremost, I know that Black women usually present and look quite young for their age. So I know that there's a lot of ageism in that. And that's something that you go through. But to walk into this room and to be spoken to in that way made me feel like, further, this must be rare. Sort of halfway in through chemo, my oncologist, who was a locum oncologist at the time, I walked in meeting him for the first time, and he said, you've got a better chance of winning the lottery than having breast cancer at your age. And I think that was like, right, I've had enough. I need to set my own thing up and look for women who look like me. So the next time I went onto the chemo ward, I started to make friends with women. There was a lot of women, actually, that I noticed that were on the chemo ward, similar in age, but there was all types of cancer. So I didn't know if everyone had breast. And as I got talking to some of the women, I couldn't believe we were going through the same thing, the ignorance. You know, I remember there was a lovely girl who was similar in age to me, who had a daughter, and when she was diagnosed with cancer, she went home and asked the parents to help her with the care of her daughter. And the parents said, you didn't catch your cancer for me, go back to where you caught it from, you know? And that was something that really shocked me. And then, you know, there was another person on the ward who told me that she couldn't tell her family that she had cancer, you know, because they see it as a taboo. So it was those initial connections I made that I was like, right, we need our own group. You know, we're up all night on steroids. You know, we're going through this horrific time. We were talking all times of night anyway. And then I could see that I started to connect with more and more people. And I was like, right, we need to find a way to come together. And I'll be honest with you, it was when I launched some blogs online about my experiences. You know, I like writing. I've always written something. I've written a book in the past. It was when I launched some blogs online, and Breast Cancer Now picked up the blogs. They were called Breast Cancer Care at the time. They picked up one of the blogs, and they published one of my blogs on their site. And they said to me specifically, we don't have many people like yourself talking about their story. Do you mind if we do this? And I said, of course. And it was when they published that blog, oh my God, I could not believe how many people reached out. And
well,
that was the real massive start of a charity that's ended up, you know, starting from something that was just like, okay, mum, can you bake some cakes? Do you think that we could have, you know, take some cups and the kettle from home? I asked my office building in Peckham, can we use your meeting room? And I'd like to host a group for women, because by that time I was talking to so many women, the experiences all echoed the same. And I was like, right, we've got to bring everybody together. And that was the early days of the charity.
It's incredible.
Thank
and
you.
Look what you're achieving at the minute. What is the aim of Black Women Rising? What do you want us all to know?
Well, it really exists to empower women of colour through their cancer diagnosis. The awareness part in the community, of course, is important, as well as the political side, fighting for better statistics, better care. But where my specialism lies and why Black Women Rising exists is from the very same ethos of why I started it in the first place. It's to empower women through their cancer diagnosis. And that is as simple as that. It's to bring women together with almost sort of, you know, the same cultures, the same backgrounds, where they can connect and find familiarity amongst each other. You know, so it's not offensive. It's not this anti-white organization. Which
no, not at all.
I mean, I've been accused of it all, to be honest with you. Race
baiting. I can imagine.
It's quite sad that people don't understand that actually in this day and age, people need their own sets of groups, not to segregate, but to be able to find familiarity. Because why? These women are facing isolation otherwise. Most of the women who come to our program are facing some sort of isolation or are not getting the help and support that they need from either their healthcare team or at home, and that is why they come to us. If they had all of that, they wouldn't come to us. They'd be happy, healthy, doing their thing and living their life.
Yeah.
But, you know, our membership has grown from 150 women last year, June, to now over 400 women. That goes to show that there is a
massive need
for a project like ours.
And I think I didn't meet another person during my breast cancer journey. I was the only breast cancer person, half the age of everyone in the room having chemo. I didn't meet anyone. And I felt so alone.
Yeah.
And you just want to talk to someone who is going through what you're going through. And I've kind of call it my tribe of doctors with cancer, because we know what it's like to be on both sides of the table. And it's so important to have that tribe of people you can go to and say, how are you coping? Is this normal? So thank you so much for giving women like you that space just to connect and know they're not alone.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you.
I wanted to ask, do you know why Black women are being diagnosed later with breast cancer? If you've got any idea why that's happening?
I would say, from what I can see, there's a few factors. I think culturally, there is a lot of really unhelpful myths and taboos around cancer, around illnesses in general, around people thinking that they can treat it on their own with prayer, religious rituals, or even medicines. You know, there's that.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of fear. I think there's a lot of fear mongering. Again, this idea and ideology of Black people don't get cancer. Cancer's a curse. It's not of God. I think there's a lot of things there. And it's fantastic, because I managed to do this most incredible trip to Ghana in the summer. And I got out there, and that just sort of proved me right, in a sense that, yes, so many women who I spoke to and who I met face to face did not come forward straight away with their symptoms. They thought that they could treat things at home or in the church or with ointments and oils and prayer. This is stuff that is happening in our communities, and it's deeply ingrained, you know?
It's almost like cancer isn't a word in the vocabulary.
No.
And a couple of listeners said, the only conversations they heard about cancer when they were growing up was when someone died from it. Getting checked, spotting the warning signs was never discussed. And they wanted to know, how can they start having these conversations with their family and friends?
Honest to God, as I keep saying to all the women, it's about when you're meeting with your friends and your family, asking people, have you checked your breast this month? It's as simple as that. It's about starting the conversation. That's why we created the Black Women Rising magazine. We wanted something really, first and foremost, it was just a fantastic, fun way to get stories across, and something really exciting to work on, which all the women played a part in, which is great. But on the flip side of that, because it was so personal and came from us as the patients, what it's been able to do is educate family, friends, helpful tips and hints, but also educate the medical professionals as well. Because on the flip side of the community and the women and the stuff that happens in the community around checking the breasts, the other biggest barrier why a lot of people are presenting later symptoms, they're not being believed. Okay. And there is racial bias, and we've got to start understanding that. It's huge. You know, I always talk about these types of examples. I think about my women who live in rural parts of the UK where there ain't many Black people, and they're turning up to surgeries and being refused point blank, doctors not wanting to touch them, not wanting to check their breasts.
Really?
Being spoken to rudely.
Oh. You know?
And this is the stuff that's happening. And we get it. You know, there is a lot of learning, as people like to call it, going on, where people are understanding about different races and cultures and the way people present themselves and the way people are speaking or way people might act is different. But I always talk about, you know, the magazine being such an amazing tool to learn so much more about our cultures and perhaps why we may react very, very different than other people when diagnosed with cancer. One of the most poignant moments again for me on the ward was when the amazing team of doctors who worked both on me and my mum, were lovely to us, were discussing another lady who I'd got close to on the ward, and they said they were describing her as difficult. She wasn't difficult. She just had never heard of the word cancer. She didn't know what it was. She didn't know that it included Black people. You know, I spoke to her. She didn't know. And she was under extreme pressure at home not to take the drugs, and for religious reasons. So again, it's about learning about the things that happen at the same time as the diagnosis and understanding that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach when people are diagnosed with these things, you know? And again, the biggest thing that keeps happening as well is that so many women are told, you're far too young to have cancer.
Yeah.
Why is that most of our membership is women under 50 years old?
We know more Black women are getting breast cancer at a younger age. Yes,
we do.
And we are trying across the board to make GPs and healthcare professionals realise it is happening to younger women. But just hearing you talk about religion took me back to a patient I described in my book. And I've worked in a very white world for most of my life.
Mm.
In Suffolk, I've mainly, and again, Cardiff, Wales is a very white population.
Yeah.
But an African woman came in for her third referral and she had a breast cancer and she'd been refusing treatment. And by the time we saw her, her breast cancer had grown. It had gone to her armpits. She was almost metastatic. And she said, I don't want treatment because Jesus is going to cure me. And this is because I haven't prayed enough. And my boss was incredible and said, your faith is really important to you, but without my help, you're going to die. And no one had been able to have that really hard conversation to say, you need to know the facts.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to do. You've never seen that. I couldn't believe someone was saying no to what I wanted to offer. And it was like an opening into this cultural world I had no knowledge of and how to deal with people who have those faiths and beliefs.
Do you know what? It's so funny you say that, Liz, because I went to a nurses' conference and it just gave me so much inspiration about where our work goes next.
Mm.
Because so
no.
We are working on things behind the scenes. But again, as I keep saying, it's so important to drive. That's why I always use this October. Yes, I'm a massive believer of cancer awareness and checking breasts. Sometimes it can be quite oversaturated.
Yeah.
I think we need to delve a little bit deeper because I do think the whole kind of agenda of the Breast Cancer Awareness Month can actually drive a lot of fear in vulnerable communities.
Yeah.
What we need to do is showcase people who've gone through the cancer treatment, have come out the other end and doing really well for themselves, because that gives people hope.
Exactly.
If I'd seen that, I wouldn't have felt half of the emotions I
yeah.
would have felt if I'd met people that had gone through it and are doing fine, are doing okay, who have taken the drugs. And that's what we need. We need to push the great examples out there.
Because yeah, we do.
A lot of fear mongering and scaring a lot of communities, and this month of October can seem so, I find it really oversaturating and exhausting at the same time.
And I think it's triggering. People who should be listening to stuff don't want to because they've had too much. You don't care. It's like, for goodness sake, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's also us asking patients, what are they scared of?
Yeah.
Rather than why don't you want the treatment, actually having that time to listen and say, what are you actually scared of, so I can help you understand what's happening, because it's completely new to you. Nem asked us, what should patients know about screening and treatment for women of different racial and ethnic groups? Should we be starting screening at an earlier age? And how could we, this is really interesting, how can we interpret all the trials about breast cancer when race and ethnic background isn't included and you're not represented in these studies?
Exactly. Well, first and foremost, we know that we need research. I tell you what, I get contacted, honest to God, probably about 100 times a month with people doing research studies.
Really?
And it's scary because obviously we are so under-resourced. We have not got, and again, I told you, our remit is about empowering women and getting
yeah.
people through their care. We don't really know how to deal with the amount of requests that come through. Is there one body that is doing a massive research piece? We don't know. And we
no.
need that because that justifies, again, our work and other things that are happening in our communities and gives us a better picture of what's going on so that we can campaign for the right things. We know the screening age for Black women needs to come a lot lower.
Yeah.
I think it needs to come a lot lower in general. The amount of women who are dying from stage 4 cancer in their 30s, early 30s at that, is absolutely
yeah.
disgraceful. So we know that screening needs to be a lot earlier. What I will say is, again, One of the things I'm finding is there's this misconception that the with the screening that actually causes breast cancer.
Yes.
Yeah,
causes. Mammograms are dangerous. No, they're not. I think the hard thing is they're not very accurate in women under the age of 40 because your breasts are dense and mammograms don't work. And there is no screening tool, which comes back to check your breasts. But it's these myths that still filter through social media.
I don't look online. I never did. I never was that person that followed Instagram accounts. I actually got rid of all my social media when I did, you know. I think it's about finding a safe space that you can trust to be able to, number one, once you've been diagnosed, to be able to say, listen, I can get my help and support from here. But actually, a lot of the noise that happens online, actually, try your best to reduce as much as that as possible, or follow the people that are just being so real, honest, open, and whatever. And that's why when you asked me to be on the podcast, I jumped to the chance, because I know the work you're doing and I know that you're incredible.
Thank you.
And let's be honest, as in this cancer world, you know, there's a lot of people that provide a lot of lip service and people I personally wouldn't follow, you know, and that's the scary thing now, is that the people are being so misled down this kind of garden rabbit hole of what cancer looks like. And it's not the truth.
No.
And we're getting a very clear picture of what it looks like behind the scenes.
And it seems to be that if you've got a million followers, you can say anything and people believe you. It's like how a cult agrees, and it's how you can break through this and just say this isn't right. There's so much we need to do. But I wanted to ask you, because I'm just so proud of everything you've done.
Thank you.
What change do you think you've been able to make so far to try and help the NHS tackle the inherent racism that does exist?
Oh, do you know what? Just the storytelling, you know? I think that was one of the biggest things from the beginning for me, was just like, let's get these stories out there. You know, our first big piece of work, because it was never called Black Women Rising before. It was just, we called the group Eat, Talk, Connect, you know? So
love it.
The first project was called Black Women Rising, and it was a series of portraits covering Black women's cancer scars.
It was incredible. I saw it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was an amazing piece of work, but it was everything about everything but the portraits. It was the storytelling.
Yeah.
And I found that was the thing that actually filtered to so many people, was that the art of storytelling and letting these women have their say about stuff. And that is where we get a lot of trusts coming to us and asking us to send their magazines in. So it's lovely to be able to walk into the waiting rooms of hospitals and things like that, that when I visit people and things, and you know, the magazines are there, you know, they're in the Macmillan centers, and people are understanding now that we are providing a unique service, and one that is accessed by a lot of women and comes highly recommended. And I think that is what's been great about this, is being able to share stories and also share stories, literature, resources, but also provide an ear. You know, any organization that contacts me for further help or to understand things or, you know, to learn, we don't turn people away, because that's what we want. We want people to learn about our experiences. We want to be able to educate people. We know not everybody understands. So I think that's the one thing that's been able to do, is we've been able to be a soundboard for a lot of trusts to be able to contact us for whatever help and support they need. And they'll never be turned away. You know, we're sending out, like, we've got this massive list of all these boxes of magazines that we've got to send out this week. And I'm like, there's not enough, but that's a good thing, because people
want. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
You don't know what you don't know. And I've been reflecting on my own practice. So we had a question from Nina, who's having a reconstruction and wanted to know how she can get a black prosthetic. And I realized, as a surgeon, I only had white prosthetics and pink nipples to show patients. And in every textbook and every photo at a conference, it was white breasts. You see an inflammatory cancer on a white breast. I knew nothing about keloid scarring. Do you think things are slowly improving?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. Lots of debates, lots of things happening. You know, I really am connected with a lot of seats at the table now, where this stuff is really being pushed forward about prosthetics. Remember, this crosses over to wigs as well. So a lot of work going on behind
the wigs.
Scenes. Yeah, it's stuff that, and it's also really is dependent on the trusts. So again, this comes down to affordability for people, because actually to get the prosthetics in a lot of places that don't have them, you have to pay for them online. We know most people don't have the resources to pay online. But what I will say is, I know that Macmillan do an amazing grant that people can access. And I know some people have used that grant to get a decent wig or whatever. Some hospitals do grants as well. You can buy softies and prosthetics. Nubian Skin partnered with the Royal Marsden to create a range of softies. You know, there is these amazing schemes happening behind the scenes. I can't tell you that they're widely available yet. Again, it depends on the trust that you are, but it's great to be able to be involved in a lot of the conversations now.
It's because brilliant.
That wasn't happening at all. My mum always talked about it all the time from when she was first diagnosed almost 30 years ago. You know, she was like, no, there was nothing like that, you know. And then this time round, she's been able to get some stuff that's in her colour, you know. So,
yeah. And I think patient power could be a huge driver for that. If every woman of colour wrote into their breast centre saying, why did you have a black prosthesis to show me instead of a white one?
Yeah.
Why do white women have to see a white prosthetic? Mm-hmm. That can change it.
Yeah, it can.
So here's a question. How can healthcare professionals improve the care that they offer to black women? And what would you say to anyone listening who is in the healthcare profession?
I think it's a really tricky one because I know that particularly with the NHS, this is the one thing I always get back from a lot of healthcare professionals. They're like, there's just too much to do. We have too many, you know, the same way we might have one patient coming in to get bad news, we have how many other people to get through. A lot of the time it's about time. My thing is, it's always about educating themselves about people's different experiences and understanding not one size fits all. And I know that whenever people have gone in to get diagnosed with breast cancer, there's usually a breast care nurse that comes in with them, and that nurse, and I get the doctor or the consultant has their role 100%, and we know that. But the job of the nurse should be to educate themselves about the further support that these women need. And I've always honed in on this because I've met some fantastic breast care nurses and I've met some not so fantastic. And that really does dictate the experience that the patient has when they've got someone who understands that their experience may be a little bit more different. Or asking the right questions. What are the questions that you can ask your patient if you know they're coming in? Is there any religious or cultural barriers to you having this? Is that, you know, with this diagnosis, is there going to be any issues at home? Have you got the right support system in place? Because if you don't, here are XYZ organisations that I think will be able to support you whilst you're going through your diagnosis. And it's as simple as that.
It is. It's like patients are people. And be able to digitally signpost them. You may not know, but if someone, it's like if every patient sent in a list of apps and books and forums and people to follow that you could then give to every patient, you're going to go on your phone, here's a list of things to Google. And if you had that for every kind of different culture to say, right, I don't know what you need, but I know these are some great places that will help you.
Yeah.
Just kind of sharing that information.
Exactly.
What can we all do to be allies or to make a tangible difference? If I see a campaign that only features white women pushing a breast cancer product, who do we reach out to? What can I do?
I always say true allyship lies in intention. I always say this because I don't think visible support is always the thing. It was the same in Black Lives Matter when people put black squares up, right?
And then nothing happened.
And then nothing happened. Or when people sort of supported us for that Black Lives Matter and then they turned their backs on us and emails started to go unanswered the following year. We're not interested in that. What we want is we want long-term allies with real intention. What we're finding is the things that provide us with lots of visibility work well. For example, I got the most amazing opportunity to go on the Lorraine show. I know that you went on, I think, the day before or after me. And, you know, went on the show and, oh my God, you know, we had about 50 new members sign up. We had all these messages saying, I've just been diagnosed. You've given me hope. These are the things we want. Oh, seeing you thrive makes me think I can do it. I'm in the early stages. This is what we need. More visibility, more places. And this is what we want. We want our allies to be able to say, look, this opportunity has come up. It's not necessarily for me, but I think it will work really well for you. And that way, look, we know as a black-led organisation, we will never get as much online support as our white counterparts and white organisations. We'll never get it. You know, I know as a black woman speaking up about inequalities in breast cancer for black women, I get trolled. I don't have many followers necessarily compared to lots of other people who do the work. I know this and I'm okay with that. I've come at peace with it. It doesn't dictate the work I'm doing or who I am. I'm glad and I'm thankful that doesn't define me. My thing is around intention and people who genuinely want to help.
Yeah.
You know, like we could do this podcast a day, Liz, and then I never speak to you again. It's about people that are saying, let's follow this up with a chat and see where we can do, or, You know, like for us, we like to get people to join our networks. We do Instagram Lives, for example. We know that this work is not done by just Black people.
No.
It is a thing we all have to do to tackle inequalities in cancer care. We've all got to join together to do it. We can't do it alone.
So is there anything women can do on a day-to-day basis to help to keep that change coming?
I think one of the things that ties nicely with this is around not just cancer, the experience of a Black woman in general, you know, particularly living in a country like this. And I think that to me is always a lovely conversation I've always had after Black Lives Matter, was the Black experience of a woman living in the UK will equal to being treated unfairly in many different fields, work, cancer, maternity, all sorts. And I think what I always love with this kind of question is saying to people to understand, get to understand a bit more and learn about Black women's experiences in general, because that could help you with any relationships you have with Black women. It could help you create healthy conversation. And I've had a lot of that actually since Black Lives Matter. It's actually been able to open up and say, you know, people say, look, I didn't even know your experience was like that. And it was like saying, actually, yeah, it is. This is how my life has been. This is how my life, you know, it's about that understanding. And that's what I always say. This work is done with love and understanding. We're not pointing fingers and not blaming anybody for anything. That's the
thing.
And
I was going to say that. I think if you want to call out a campaigner because they don't have Black women in it, don't be negative.
Oh,
it's like saying thank you, because the hate gets nowhere. And it, maybe they tried really hard and no Black women wanted to come forward. Say thank you very much, but next time could you consider? I do it on medical conferences. We call them manuals, or there's just a row of white men. And actually, let me help you find women of colour to come and speak. Let me help. And I think it's being really positive to try and drive that change and make them think rather than make them hate you for calling them out.
Exactly.
Social media can be so toxic.
It's one of my pet hates, and I've had to have strong words with people when they're like, you know, going on campaigns, I can't believe da-da-da-da. And you're right. I know. I speak to brands. They find it hard.
Yeah.
To diversify their campaigns. They find it really difficult to attract people to come forward, especially because, as I keep saying, you know, people see me talking about breast cancer and get trolled and vilified. Why the hell would they want to do it? Why the hell are these women going to want to do it themselves? And, you know, so I think you're right. It's about calling people out, but doing it in a way that's private and with love and care, you know, and that's always been my motto, you know, this whole thing. I don't hold any hate or grudges in my heart for anything that I've seen. And I've seen some pretty crappy shit, you know, and women treated in an awful way. And it's took me a while to get here, but I've noticed no change comes like that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So do you have any words of wisdom for any Black women with breast cancer listening to this episode today? How can they get the best treatment or outcomes?
My biggest thing is that they don't have to go through it alone, because there's an organisation, like Black Women Rising, waiting with a warm hug, a cup of coffee or tea, you know, a couple times a month for you to come and really immerse yourself within the programme. There's so many different facets to the program that they can come and be a part of. So first and foremost, that is it, you know. And again, going back to my own diagnosis, I wish I had that. And that's why I've created it. I've created it off of what I didn't have and what would have been so helpful for me. The second thing what I would say is as well is around just making sure they advocate for themselves, you know, and trusting how they feel, you know, and not downplaying anything that they're feeling, anything that they're, you know, and also if they feel that they're not being listened to, taking someone with them as well.
Yeah.
That is a thing that's happening a lot, is that women are advocating for themselves, going into these rooms with two or three doctors and being told what they're going to do and being told this is how things are and being so overwhelmed they're not taking everything in. So I would just say, advocate for yourself. Get informed about what's going on. Take time to do that, you know, and just know they're not going through it alone. But also as well, there are some other amazing services out there. The Macmillan phone line, you've got the Breast Cancer Now phone line. We now run a nurse support line as well, which is fantastic. So there's so many different places that they can call for help that can support them in so many different ways now.
Brilliant. And you've got your own podcast now with Black Women Rising, haven't you?
Yes, we have. We didn't release a series this year, but we've got one coming out in January, which is really cool. So I'm excited to be working on that soon.
Brilliant. So everyone should head to the website.
I'll ask you to come on that.
I'll happily come on. But I think even if you're not a black woman with breast cancer, it's worth going to have a look at the website, Black Women Rising, and just seeing the stories of things that are happening. It's a bit like Me Too. People didn't believe it was happening until they read the stories. And I think you need to know what's happening to everybody so we can truly make a difference.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on, Leanne. It's been amazing.
Thank you, Liz.
That was Leanne Perro, MBE, and oh my goodness, what an episode. I feel ashamed that I didn't know any of this was happening, and it's so empowering to know that change is going to happen. I think my takeaway for this week is this. There is support available for women of colour through charities like Black Women Rising, and if we see discrimination, we need to call it out. And it reminds me of a post I saw on Twitter a few years ago that said, "The standard you walk past is the standard you accept." And it's always stayed with me. And now it's time for our poem of the week from Donna Ashworth, our resident poet. Her new book, Wild Hope, is going down a storm. And whenever I'm wobbling, which happens quite a lot these days, I dip into it and I come out feeling hopeful again. Have a listen to this.
The Woman Before. It is not just your mother who may walk with you in spirit. It is her mother too, and her mother's mother, and her mother's friends who loved by choice and not blood, and the woman before them. Generations and generations of female energy, watching in admiration as you forge ahead, living better, feeling better, accepting better than they ever did, as they very much hoped you would. So, when you feel low, lonely, or unloved, remember them, feel them. They are with you, and they burn brightly with their boundless light in everything you do. You, my friends, are the moment in time of many women gone before, and you will lay pathways like they did for those who come up next. What a beautiful, unending legacy.
Isn't she amazing? That was Donna Ashworth reading her poem, The Women Before, from her new book, Wild Hope. Now, if you want to read more of Donna's poems, or find out about today's guest, Leanne Perro, MBE, or her amazing project, Black Women Rising, or you've got a question you'd like me to answer on the show, you'll find all the details in the show notes. Next week, I'm going to be talking all about lymphedema with Dr. Melanie Thomas from Lymph Wales. You've sent me so many questions, and it was important that I covered it for you. We'll tell you why you don't need to be scared and what you can do to reduce your risk of getting it.
This fear has been created, and we've got to really take on board lymphedema is manageable. Yes, it's shit that you get it, but you know what? We can live with lymphedema. We can control it. It's not going to control us.
I'm Dr. Lisa Reardon. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. So Now I've Got Breast Cancer is produced by Birdline Media.